This is 4:55 on Wednesday, September 13th. All right, good morning. So, I hope you found the interview format with Bob interesting on Monday. I learned something that actually is going to hopefully change a little bit of what we do later in this class. Bob sort of brought to my attention the opinion of the internet community that this large amount of UDP traffic that is occurring in the net now is a real risk for the stability of the network and the risk of congestion collapse, and he said that the SCTP protocol was beginning to be adopted sort of more broadly, and that they're sort of encouraging this to reduce the risk of this kind of collapse thing. Well, it turns out that there's nothing in this class that talks about SCTP, and so one of the things that I need to do before we finish is actually get in a little bit of discussion about that, hopefully at the point when we talk about transport layer protocols. So there's nothing in the book. We're going to have to go get some other resources, but I think that's an important thing. Second thing, because of Bob's talk and sort of how we were progressing anyway, it appears that we are going to be a bit behind on the previously published schedule, and in particular, I've moved the exam one date from Friday the 27th to Monday the 30th in order to make sure that we get through everything associated with Chapter 3 before then, and it should not be a problem. Second thing that I will do, but have not yet done, is move the assignment date for Project 1 to Friday and move the due date for that back by a week, a full week, so that it's still due on a Monday. So those are changes that are coming to the schedule. Is having the exam on the 30th going to be an issue? I mean, it could be an issue on the 27th as well, so it's just... And anybody using the Access Center is going to have to sort of reschedule that, let them know about that. Okay. I thought we would start today with some clicks questions, just to get brains back in gear on the topic. Topics. So, yes. This. I'm having internet access trouble this morning.
Me too.
Me three. Okay, well, maybe we'll dispense with the clicks questions, because I was not having trouble upstairs, but down here it seems... What? It's what?
It is the dungeon, so maybe...
There's a question. You can see a question right now, but it's very slow. There it is. All right. Well, let's try it and see what we can do. All right. Indeed, it's HTTP 1.1 introduced persistent connections that allow multiple requests over the same TCP connection. And remember, what that saves is the overhead, the round trip overhead of setting up a TCP connection for every object on a page. A mail user agent is a mail server. Yeah, that's false. User agents are clients. They're not servers. The purpose of using mail servers in the internet mail architecture is, maybe this should say NSA instead of FBI. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, these are just sort of warm-up questions. Yes. Allow mail to be sent to a recipient who's currently offline. I mean, we have other things more recent, like chat systems for talking to people who are online, but offline is the domain of email. It uses a store and forward architecture, but you wouldn't necessarily say that that is the purpose, and similarly it does allow mail to be stored a long period of times, but again it's not the purpose. All right, so now we're getting to to some stuff that's going to be useful for today. IP network layer protocol provides what? Considerable disagreement when it's present. Keeps disappearing. Yeah? Okay. So what's going on here? IP network layer protocol is about best effort datagram service. Right? We implement stream service above the top of the best effort datagram service. And so when we talk about TCP, we're talking about a transport layer protocol that lives over top of the network layer protocol. And it's the transport layer protocol that produces the stream service and makes it reliable. Clicking on my power supply does not result. Yes.
I've got a graph of the internet, like it's dropping up every 3 seconds.
Okay. It definitely having troubles this morning. Definitely having troubles. Okay, keep this one in mind. I'm not going to discuss this one now. We'll talk about this one in the course of the lecture today. But it's not right. The consensus that's developing is not right, and we'll talk about why. Okay, I'll stop with that. It's too painful. Next thing. Did I start this? So, the next thing that I wanted to do today, so that was just to sort of get everybody's head back in the space of networking. Next thing I want to do today is talk about some of the problems from the homeworks. In particular, problem chapter 1, problem 2, and problem 9, and 12, and chapter 2, problem 9. So you've gotten back feedback, right, on chapter 1 already? And and I should introduce our TA, who I think hasn't been here before. This is Hawk, and he is a 10-hour TA for this class. He grades homeworks, and I haven't asked him. Have I asked you about office hours yet? Okay, I will ask him about office hours, and he'll be an alternative resource for you sometimes to come and get help with things. But he's thorough in his grading, and I think can provide valuable feedback. So, problem 2 in chapter 1 was this one that asked about if you have rate R connections and you want to send N links or N connections and you want to send P packets of length L, how long does it take? And it said start from the observation that over one link it takes N times L over R, right? So L over R is the amount of time it takes you to send L bits over an R bit per section, R bit per second link, and if you have to send it over N of them with store and forward packet switching sort of technique. You have to send it entirely to here. It has to be gathered, and then you send it here, and it's gathered, and so it takes N times as long. And the question was, now suppose that you want to send P packets over this same path. How long will that take? And it's not P times N times L over R. Why? Because if you were to, this would be the answer if you were to send the first packet all the way and then only after it were all the way to the end start sending the next one. And that's not what happens. We send the first one and it gets here, and when that happens we can start sending the second one, so that in fact all of these are busy at the same time most of the time. So it doesn't take that long. So how long does it take, and how can you think about it? Well, I think the easiest way to think about it is that after N times L over R amount of time, the first packet has been delivered, right? And the second one is sitting here, and the third one is here, and the fourth one is being started there. So after the first one is delivered, you start getting one packet every L over R seconds, right? The time that it takes to send it over this last link. And that goes on until you've gotten all the packets. So this one does. So It is N times L over R. That's the first packet. Plus P minus 1 times L over R for each of the remaining P minus 1 packets. Okay? So a lot of people didn't catch up on that. So that's fine. Questions about that one? Problem 1.9. I think part A was not a problem in circuit switching. This was the problem about you have a 1 gigabit per second link and each user requires 100 kilobits per second. If you're using circuit switching where every user has its full bandwidth reserved, you divide 100 kilobits per second into 1 gigabit per second and you find out that you support 10,000 simultaneous users. The part B of this said, think about this a statistical sharing situation in which users sort of randomly send with a certain probability. So you randomly send at a given time with probability P, there are M total users, and we ask, what is the probability that more than N users are sending at a given time? All right, so this is a binomial distribution problem, and really, you know, what we're asking is really a question about the cumulative distribution function from 0 up to M. Somewhere in between is N. The probability that more than N users are sending at a given time, and it's kind of a S-shaped curve that looks like that, right? If you think about it. But that's sort of the conceptual picture, but they ask for a formula. So how do you get to that formula? Well, you have to think about how many ways there are for N senders, specifically N senders, to be sending at a given time. And if you've had STAT 360 or something, this should be bringing back memories, I hope. But there are M choose N different ways of choosing N people to be sending out of the M, and the probability that each of those is sending like that, and then you also have to have the probability that the others are not sending, so that's 1 minus P to the M minus N. Right? And that's the probability that exactly N are sending. I do this right, Hawk? He's our expert. Yes? All right. But we're asked, what's the probability that more than n are ascending? So you just sum over the probabilities out to the right, and that is and then you say, all right, so this is the probability that more than n are ascending. And I guess the thing that apart from sort of just not getting this at all, that tripped people up is you got to watch out for what they say, what is said in a problem about sort of the specifics of the boundary condition. So here it said the probability that more than n are ascending. So it starts with j equal n plus 1 and not j equal n. So just watch out for that. I mean, it's not going to make a huge difference in any of these calculations, but I like to point out being computer scientists, we have to watch out for one off by one errors. Okay, problem 1.12.
Question about on the exam, will we be expected to know the binomial theorem or any of the other probability distributions, I guess?
No.
Okay.
No.
Because most of us don't know it off the top.
No, exactly. Better to do those in homeworks than in exams. Okay, so problem 1.12 was about queuing delay, and suppose that there are, I'll just do 1.12b. Suppose that there are a certain number of packets already present in the queue when a new packet arrives, and that the packet that you're sending has been sent, a certain number of bits have been already been sent. What is the queuing delay associated with the packet that's just arriving? And maybe the only tricky thing here is, so there are n full packets queued and x bits of the currently being sent packet already sent. Packets are of length L. And probably the only tricky thing here is to recognize that the queuing delay associated with the currently arrived packet does not include the time to send that packet. That would be called its transmission delay. So the queuing delay is just n times L over R for the queued packets plus L minus X, the amount left of the currently being sent packet. Okay, so you don't include the packet that just arrived in calculating its queuing delay. Okay? Anything about this bothersome? Shouldn't be. Simple algebra. And finally, problem 2.9. I don't think Hawk's graded these yet, but there were quite a few questions about this. And the big problem, I guess, with this one is that it seems like there isn't enough information given in the problem. Right? This is the one about what is the average access time given that you have some queuing delay on the router and then you add in a web cache and what does that do to it. So the givens in the problem are that the object size is 850 times 10 to the 3 bits. That's in the problem. It says that there are 16 requests per second. It says that there's a 3-second latency to the router at the far side of the enterprise link. So the picture here is we've got our LAN, we've got our enterprise router, we've got our enterprise link, and then out here we have the internet. And it says that the latency here is 3 seconds after the request leaves. You know, you make a request here, it travels over this link, it goes out into the internet and comes back 3 seconds later, the answer is here, and the question is, and then how long does it take to get back here? And that clearly depends on the rate of this link, and that it doesn't say in the problem statement, but it does say back in the original text that it refers to. Okay, so that was the kind of tricky. So anyway, that rate is R here is whatever it was, 15 megabits per second. Okay. But this wasn't the point of the problem. It seemed to be a sticking point, but it wasn't the learning point of the problem. The learning point of the problem how does traffic intensity or utilization affect essentially queuing delay, or really total delay. Okay, and it says that the it really talks about the total delay, not the queuing delay. The total delay is delta over 1 minus beta times delta, where delta is the transmission time for a single packet, and beta is the number of packets No, that's not right. Where delta is the Yeah, that's right. Beta is the number of packets per second. Yeah. Okay. And so you can plug in all those numbers and calculate things. And the only thing that is now tricky about this is that beta changes when you have a cache. Confession time, first time I did this, I didn't notice that. Okay, but beta changes when you have a cache. And so the effect, therefore, is not only that the requests that are served by the cache get faster response, but also the requests that are not served by the cache, the requests that actually go out to the internet, also get faster response as a result of lightening that load. So I'm not going to go through those numbers because we've certainly spent enough time already on this. But okay, so those were the ones that I thought were probably the most challenging. Are there any other problems that you would like me to consider going over in class from these two problem sets?
Maybe number 7.
Number 7 in chapter 2?
Yeah, I'm just looking
at it. Okay. Email me if you'd like me to do that. I'd be happy to consider it. All right, but meanwhile, we need to finally get on and talk about socket programming. So, switching to the Donahue and Calvert book and going quickly through stuff. I just put all their slides up here because they're a good review. How do we make computers talk? How are they interconnected? The Internet Protocol, yes. IP, and this is why I wanted those review questions this morning. IP is a datagram packet protocol, best effort service. It allows loss, reordering, duplication, and delay, and it provides delivery to hosts, not to applications. We talked about this before, right? At the IP layer, it's just hosts. IP addresses, in IP version 4 at least, are 32-bit identifiers that we write as 4 decimal numbers corresponding to the 4 bytes making up the 32 bits. We have a DNS system that will look up names and translate them to IP addresses. And when we're careful, we say that this IP address actually defines a host interface and not a host, because a host could have many different interfaces and each could have a different IP, and typically would have a different IP address. Okay? All review. So that IP stuff is not sufficient. In particular, doesn't provide reliable byte stream delivery. It doesn't provide flow and congestion control. And it doesn't provide addressing of applications on hosts. So the idea of port numbers gets introduced to talk about different processes running on hosts. And these are introduced at the transport protocol layer, not the IP layer. All right? So ports are 16-bit identifiers. Okay. So then how do you actually program, write programs that can use these facilities of the Internet? And the answer is the sockets interface. And Bob talked about this and how it came about back in the days of the ARPANET ARPA had people working on the networking piece and they had people working on the operating systems piece, and they sort of insisted that they get together enough to define a way for the operating system to help applications talk to the network. And the result was the definition of what's called the Berkeley socket interface, and it comes out of this Berkeley Systems Department Unix version that was created at that time. And so the socket interface is what we use to talk to the network from within applications through operating systems. So sockets are a very flexible abstraction in the operating system. We're going to just plumb a very small subset of their capabilities in dealing with how they are used for the Internet. So you have to say a socket is associated with a particular protocol and a particular local address, certainly, and sometimes also a particular remote address. And now we can look at this picture. So each application process can have many sockets associated with it. And remember, a socket is just an operating system level abstraction. There's nothing in the Internet that says anything about sockets. Sockets are implemented by the operating system. They're a data structure, essentially, and a pointer to it that applications can refer to. So an application can have many sockets, and sockets can even be shared between applications. That's not... we use that a little bit. But typically it's sort of something that you do. You sort of pass a socket from one application to another, or one process to another, rather than actively using it from multiple processes at once. So there are TCP sockets, there are UDP sockets, you can mix them up. They're just an abstraction at the of seeing networking through the operating system. So within the operating system level down here, the sockets are hooked up to stuff that says what networking facilities they're using. So they have IP addresses associated with them, and they have port numbers associated with them. And that's how applications can talk to IP, which lives way down here, far away from them in the operating system. So I said that you have to say for a socket what kind of socket it is, that is, what protocols it's using. And this is all defined in a set of constants that are defined in header files provided by the operating system. So when you, to get a socket from an application, you make a call on the socket operation of the operating system. You have to tell it what family socket you want. And in our case, it will always be protocol family internet. Okay, so we're talking about internet sockets. There are sort of local sockets on the machine that you can talk about. There are other kinds of networking sockets. Those are not what we're doing. We're doing internet sockets, so always be that. And then you have to tell the operating system, well, what kind of socket is this as far as the application's interaction with it go? Is it a stream socket, which means that it's just a stream of bytes? Or is it a datagram socket, which means that you will get defined chunks of data back, right? So each message will be a separate thing as opposed to just a stream of bytes that come in when they come in. That's the type field. And then you also have to tell it the protocol that's going to be used to implement that. And so this is sort of farther away down in the networking layer. And in the case of stream sockets for internet sockets, you have to use, at least at this stage, TCP as the internet protocol that supports a stream socket as seen by the application, and you use UDP as the protocol when you have a datagram socket. All right? And there are lots of references that you can use for finding out about stuff like this. On a Linuxy system, if you just do man socket, it will tell you a lot about this. Windows programmers have other kinds of resources that are not something that I know a lot about. You guys probably know more about how to explore the WinSock interfaces in the documentation, but it will be very similar. Windows uses the same essential collection of calls here. The parameters are a little different, but the concepts are exactly the same. All right. So the next thing that we need to deal with is, so you make a socket very easily by just saying what sort of socket it is. Type, stream, or datagram, protocol. But we're rapidly going to get to, in the next slide, the issue of how do you tell the operating system what addresses you want to use with your sockets. And this is where we run into the paucity of capabilities in the C programming language for dealing with sort of variant structures. So what they did was they said, all right, for all kinds of sockets, there's this struct that says, that corresponds to addresses of all kinds, okay? And the way it works is it's just two bytes that say what address family this address belongs to, and then 14 bytes of blob, right? when you're talking about struct sock adders, you don't really know what's in there. Then what you do is pointer casting between these things and different specific kinds of address family specific addresses to talk about, say, internet addresses. And an internet address is the right, you have pointers. Draw pictures. You have a single pointer. You have a single pointer that points there and there. And the question is, how do you interpret the data that's being pointed to by that pointer? You do pointer cast, right, on the type. So this pointer is pointing sort of generically at one of those. It starts with a two-byte thing that says what family. In the case that it's an internet socket address, those first two bytes must be the constant AF INET. Okay. Now, what is that number? I certainly don't know off the top of my head. You always do it by including the appropriate header file and using the named constant AF INET. Okay? Second part is the port number, two bytes, 16 bits. Then comes the internet address, 4 bytes, 32 bits. So that makes up 6 bytes out of the 14, and the rest is not used for an internet address. Yes?
Is there a reason you have two structures? So you have struct an address.
Oh, why is this one a struct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, why is that? Because, yeah, it's another unsigned long. Why did they do that? I don't know why they did that. It's a very fine question. Why did they do that? And I'm sure there's a good reason. This has been bashed on for 40 years, so I'm sure they have a good reason for that, but I don't know what it is. Okay, so we will get to the use of these structs here in a little bit. So, remember the client-server model. The client is the initiator of the connection, and the server is passively waiting for the client to contact it. So here are the steps executed by both the client and the server. And we're going to go through these steps in some detail and look at the system calls that support both of them. So the server's behavior is that it creates a TCP socket, say, using that socket call that we looked at before. It assigns a port to that socket, and then it sets the socket into what's called listen state. Okay, that's how the server expresses to the server process expresses to the operating system that it's passively waiting for a client to come along and connect to it. And then the server does, sort of in a loop, an operating system call that accepts a client connection. So when a client actually shows up, the server has to do something to actually serve that client. It communicates by doing send and receive operations and ultimately closes the connection. Okay, and then sort of farther off the end here, at some point the server process is going to go away entirely and it will close the listening socket as well, and everything will be will be fine. Clients have an easier job of it. They just create a socket. They connect to the server that they want to talk to. They communicate by sending and receiving, and then close the connection. So servers are more complicated. Clients are easy. We'll start with the servers. All right, so we're going to step through the behavior of a server. It starts by creating a socket using the socket system call. It's from the Internet Protocol family. It's a stream socket and it's a TCP socket. And notice the idiom here. This is an important programming idiom. Whenever you make a system call, what do? You check the result to make sure that it is successful. So if socket returns something less than zero, it indicates that the socket call failed, and you better not try to go on, because things will only get worse from that point on. So this is an important idiom that you always check the results of system calls. So the next thing that the server does is associate a particular port number with that socket. And how does it do that? Well, here's where we come up with the where we start using these inadder structs. We fill in we create a struct inadder in which the family is internet family. The host address is any host address. This is sort of a wild card, and it's expressed by this named constant inadder any. And then we assign the port number that we want to use as our port number in this application. So this EchoServe port here is a number that we picked. Okay? It can be any number bigger than 1024. At least in Unix systems, port numbers less than 1024 are reserved for super user or root owned processes. So EchoServe port. We'll talk about why we call H2NS on that port number here in a second, or maybe next time. Has to do with byte orders. So we set up one of these structs, and then we call bind. Okay, so bind is the second system call that's involved in this process. The first one was socket, then bind, and we pass to it the socket we received from the socket system call, the address that we want it to have, and it turns out we also have to tell it how big that is, which is a pain in the neck. And again, we want to make sure that this succeeds. And, you know, the kinds of reasons this will fail is because somebody's already using the port that you just asked to use. Okay. Not allowed. Am I out of time? I'm out of time. So next time, we will finish this bunch of stuff and go on to some more issues. Socket per
in. I was not entirely sure where we got the code from.